a happy leap day birthday to Kevin Brady of Dow's. Now, my note here says that Kevin turns 10 years old today, and I don't know whether that means that he's actually 10 years old or whether this is Kevin's 10th leap day birthday. I don't know. But whichever it is, happy birthday, Kevin. I hope you enjoy this special leap day birthday. It doesn't come around often enough, I'm sure. Well, you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you are hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now we'll turn to obituaries, and Linda is here with the first one.
I'm smiling about Kevin's possible birthday. Okay, going to obituaries. From Johnston, Connie Lou Houghton, 68, passed away on Tuesday, February 27th, with her loving family by her side. A visitation will be held Thursday, February 29th, from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Isles Westover Chapel on Hickman Road in Des Moines. Attendees are encouraged to wear their favorite sports team apparel. A funeral ceremony will be held Friday, March 1st at 11 a.m. at Grace Lutheran Church on Urbandale Avenue in Des Moines. The funeral will be live streamed, and you may view it on gracedesmoines.org/live. A burial will follow at Sunny Hill Cemetery in Grimes, Iowa. If you are unable to attend the funeral service, feel free to join the reception afterwards at Grimes Community Complex at 1 p.m. Connie was born the youngest of six children on August 15, 1955, in Carroll, Iowa, to Lawrence and Melinda Fleshner Houghton. She grew up on the family farm and attended Glidden-Ralston Community School from kindergarten through 12th grade, graduating in May of 1973. She moved to the Des Moines area immediately after graduation and resided there ever since. She graduated from the American Institute of Business in Des Moines and attended Des Moines Area Community College in Ankeny. Connie began working part-time at age 16, and she became a full-time employee with Dial Finance, Northwest Financial, and Wells Fargo, where she would continue to work for 40 years. After retirement, she worked with Des Moines University for 10 years as a standardized patient. Connie became a mom to Kurt Chenoweth in 1986, which was the best thing that happened in her entire lifetime, and becoming a grandma to Jack in 2013, Owen in 2015, and Nico Chenoweth in 2023, he was a bonus. Connie volunteered in various capacities for over 25 years with Grace Lutheran Church, including Altar Guild, Choir, Member Care, and First Circle Friends. She enjoyed traveling, going out with family and friends, Iowa State Athletics, Chicago and Iowa Cubs, and golf. Some of her most memorable highlights included many Big 8 and Big 12 basketball tournaments, Cubs World Series game, and the Masters. When Connie reflected on what she has learned in life, she credited the following. My mom taught me how to take care of myself. My dad taught me how to take care of others. My sister Shirley taught me the love of reading. My sister Dia taught me, or at least provided a great example of, patience. My brother Larry taught me to have a sense of humor. My sister Linda taught me the love of music. My brother Lonnie taught me everything sports related. My son Kurt and grandsons Jack, Owen, and Nico taught me the deepest unconditional love possible. Connie is survived by her son Kurt Chenoweth and grandsons Jack and Owen Chenoweth, with Sarah partner Humpke Chenoweth, and Nicholas Nico Chenoweth with Jessica Rice, her former spouse Ron Chenoweth, her sisters Shirley Disney of Urbandale, Deanna partner Bill Slocum of Carroll, and Linda Reed of Ankeny, her brother Lonnie partner Lois Houghton of Glidden, Iowa, her sister-in-law, Jane Houghton of Des Moines, 16 nieces and nephews, 42 great-nieces and nephews, and many great-great-nieces and nephews. She is preceded in death by her parents, her brother Larry Houghton, her brothers-in-law, Jack Disney and Donald Reed, and nephew, Jerry Slocum. Memorial contributions may be made to Grace Lutheran Church, the ALS Association Iowa Chapter, or Suncrest Hospice. Elaine June Bredesky, 89, passed away February 24th in Des Moines. Elaine was born on June 21st, 1934, on her family farm near Meckling, South Dakota. She graduated from a one-room schoolhouse, Meckling High School, Grandview College, and Drake University with a B.S. in education in 1956. Elaine taught third grade in Des Moines Public Schools and students with disabilities at Camp Sunnyside. Through the years, she volunteered on committees supporting education in her community. While attending Grandview College, she met Lou Buddy Bredesky of Des Moines. They were married in August 1956. During their 59 years together, they raised their three children and found time for friends, family, auto racing, and cruising in their roadsters. Elaine and Lou became involved with Friendship Force. They traveled and hosted new friends from around the world. They were active members at Luther Memorial Church. Elaine enjoyed researching and sharing the family's genealogy and history. She kept Danish and Slavic traditions alive, such as making Abelskiver and tortellini with her children and grandchildren. Elaine is survived by her children, Mike, partner Jan Stamps, Jill, partner Justin Fishbaugh, and Kay, partner Michael Dry. Grandchildren, Kyle Bredesky, Logan, partner Lauren Grant Bredesky, Seth Dry, and Luke Dry. She's preceded in death by her husband, Lou, her parents, Nels and Mary Nelson, and brother, Harlan Nelson. A celebration of life will take place March 2nd at 10:30 a.m. at Luther Memorial Church on Grandview Avenue in Des Moines. There will be a visitation prior to the service from 8:30 to 10 a.m. Following a brief private interment after the service, the family will return to the church for continued fellowship. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to Luther Memorial Church or Grandview University. May Elaine's memory be a source of comfort and inspiration to all who knew her. Online condolences can be expressed at hamiltonsfuneralhome.com.
Janelle Cox peacefully passed away on February 26 at Iowa Methodist Hospital in Des Moines. Jane Janelle Brownlee Cox was born November 20, 1927, to Harold and Dorothy Farrow Brownlee of Mallard, Iowa. She graduated from Mallard High School in 1945 and then worked as the school secretary. In 1947, she moved to Des Moines to attend the American Institute of Business. There she met and married George M. Cox on June 5, 1948, and they had three children, Larry, Deborah, and Kelly. In 1948, she began working for the law firm of Gibson, Stewart & Garrett before leaving the workforce to raise a family and do in-home typing for Look magazine over many years. From 1968 to 1977, she worked the desk at Plaza Lanes, followed by Drake University's Law Library, until her retirement in 1992. She was a lifelong member of Emmanuel United Methodist Church, serving as president of the women's group, United Methodist Women, for 10 years. An avid sports fan, she loved her Hawkeyes and went to many bowling games with her husband. They also enjoyed playing bridge, bowling, traveling, and golfing. During many years of camping with family, they visited 38 national parks and many state parks. In Iowa, they often camped with friends and family at Springbrook and Cherry Glen. Travels included vacations to Alaska and Europe. After the passing of her husband in 2014, she moved to Walnut Ridge Retirement Community in 2019, where she continued playing bridge, watching as many sports as she could, and enjoying family gatherings. She is survived by her children, Larry and partner Barbara Cox of Clive, Debbie, partner Dan Koopman of Cedar Rapids, and Kelly, partner John Putney of Urbandale, a brother, H. John, partner Pat Brownlee of California, 6 grandchildren, and 5 great-grandchildren. Janelle never met a stranger, always welcoming and loved everyone she met. The family would like to extend a special thanks to the staff and residents at Walnut Ridge for the special care, love, and friendship they provided to Janelle. A celebration of life will be held on Saturday, March 2nd at 1 p.m. in the Walnut Room at Walnut Ridge Senior Living Community in Clive. Memorials may be given to St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. And this is Dateline New Virginia, Reba K. Hendrickson Reed. Reba passed away on February 26. Services will be held at Kale Funeral Home Friday, March 1st at 1 p.m. The family will greet friends Thursday, 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. with an Eastern Star service at 7 p.m. Interment will be in the New Virginia Cemetery. Online condolences may be left at the Kale Funeral Home website. Left to cherish her memory are her children, daughters Anna Marie, partner Craig Young, Melissa Lee Reed, with her friend Gary Klein, and son John Nicholas Reed. Alice Betty Ogburn of Osceola passed away on February 26. Betty is survived by her children, Patrick J., partner Karen Ogburn of Kimberly City, Missouri, William, known as Bill E., partner Diane Ogburn of Osceola, Stephen M. Ogburn of Grand River, Mary K., partner Chris Baumgartner of St. Charles, Missouri. A service will be held on Saturday, March 2nd at Kale Funeral Home in Osceola with visitation from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. Burial of her cremains will follow at Gregg Cemetery. Condolences may be shared at the Kale Funeral Home website. And we have 2 death notices that are not accompanied by obituaries. Edith Fitchner, age 80, of Ankeny, passed away on February 26. Arrangements are being handled by Binky Funeral Home in Hubbard. The service will be March 1st at 11 a.m. at First United Methodist Church with interment at Hubbard Cemetery. And Rosetta Marine Robinson, age 86, of Des Moines, passed away on February 24. Hamilton's funeral home is handling the arrangements. The service time is at 11 a.m. on March 1st and be held at Hamilton's funeral home. It does not say which location of Hamilton's, but I'm sure their website will have that information. Interment will be at Glendale Cemetery. And now, continuing with our news, here's Linda.
Well, I'm going to go back to the Metro section. There's one article we didn't read. Dexfield Diner and Pub Owners Looking to Rebuild After Fire. This from Redfield. On the corner of the main drag in tiny Redfield, the smell of smoke lingered in the air on a windy Tuesday morning as a husband and wife stared into what was, just the day prior, their restaurant. Devastated was the first word that came to mind when the co-owner of Dexfield Diner and Pub, Steve Roberts, stared into the building that housed his restaurant for 2 years. Windows of the building were busted out, shards of glass lay on the curb, and workers clad in overalls and helmets with lights scraped through the building where a fire tore through the first and second floors on Monday. "Besides my family, this was my life," Roberts said as he stared into the soot-covered building. Located just off the Raccoon River Valley Trail, the restaurant that specializes in pizzas and sandwiches has been popular with cyclists and locals alike. Dexfield Diner and Pub, which was in a building that was built in 1901 at 904 First Street, is closed Mondays for cleaning. Roberts was outside when the fire began in the afternoon. I just freaked out when I realized what was going on, Robert said. I tried going in the front door, but the door was too hot, and I tried going through the back, but it was too smoky. Roberts called 911, and the fire department was dispatched. Multiple fire departments came to battle the blaze. One of the only things that was saved was a basketball that read, "No one fights alone." The basketball, which was signed by a friend's son who died from cancer, was almost like a sign, Robert said. The fire department brought it out from the fire, Robert said. It hit hard when I saw it. Roberts was standing outside of the damaged restaurant with his wife and co-owner of the restaurant, Christy Roberts, on Tuesday morning, just a little under 24 hours after the fire happened. The couple was set to speak with investigators. "Devastation is a powerful feeling, but so is determination," the couple said. "We want to know what we can do to rebuild as fast as we can," Christy Roberts said. "We're ready. We need that first step right now. The community has always used this place as a social hub." Community members in Redfield contacted the Roberts on the day of the fire to tell them how much the restaurant meant to them, Christy Roberts said. "It's hard because there were so many memories that were made here," Steve Roberts said. "We're just small town people. We're not rich. We just love doing what we do. This is our life. Her and I sold everything to build this restaurant." The Redfield Fire Department did not immediately respond to requests for comment on what may have caused the fire.
And that concludes the Metro and Iowa section. We'll return now to the front page section of the paper. And here's that article we promised you about some background information regarding the six who are running for Des Moines City Council vacancy, the at-large seat. Six candidates are seeking the at-large Des Moines City Council seat, formerly held by now Mayor Connie Boson. Voters will choose the new members in a special election on March 19. The winner will serve the remainder of Boson's term, which runs through January of 2026. She vacated the seat when she was sworn in as mayor this year. Interested candidates had to file to run by February 23. Because the at-large position represents the entire city, any Des Moines resident who is 18 or older and is not convicted as a felon can run. Here is who has filed. And these are listed alphabetically by last name. Dr. Claudia Addy. Addy, a retired physician, says she's running to encourage solutions at a city level. Addy, who says she is not a one-trick pony, wants to address issues such as waste management, transportation, and city communication, as well as clearing junk cars from properties. Among her various jobs, Addy works in administration and the ticket office at Wells Fargo Arena and at a salvage yard in DeSoto, Iowa. She lives in the North Grand area. Benjamin Clark. Clark, a farmer and a founder of Iowa Firm Foundation, an education nonprofit, wants to restore Des Moines as a commerce hub. If elected, Clark wants to address taxes, crime, city roads, development and housing, encourage trade school education, and promote Iowa travel, tourism, and agriculture. Clark lives on Des Moines' south side. Clark previously filed nomination paperwork for both the mayor and Ward 2 seats in the November 2023 elections, but was disqualified because candidates cannot file for multiple offices. Justin Lewis. If elected, Lewis, a landscape business owner and activist, wants to advocate for criminal justice reform, affordable housing, food security, and neighborhood revitalization, according to his campaign website. He is a member of the Iowa Certified Public Management Program and a fellow with Des Moines New Leadership Council. Lewis lives in the Lower Beaver neighborhood. He previously ran for the at-large city council seat in 2021. Robert Bobby Pate. Pate, an Iowa State government employee and criminal justice reform advocate, says he's a candidate who can communicate with all different types of people. If elected, Pate says he wants to continue his work in criminal justice reform and create more opportunities for underrepresented community leaders. Pate grew up in Iowa and currently lives in downtown Des Moines. Mike Simonson. If elected, Simonson, an architect, says he wants to increase outreach to historically underserved residents, add affordable housing options, revitalize neighborhoods, invest in public safety, and prioritize fiscal responsibility, according to his campaign website. Simonson served on the Des Moines Planning and Zoning Commission for 12 years and on boards for Greater Des Moines Botanical Garden and Hoyt Sherman Place. And finally, Rose Marie Smith. Smith, who lives in the Cheatham Park neighborhood, is running for the at-large seat to serve everyone. If elected, she says she wants to address homelessness as well as advocate for the Des Moines Area Regional Transit Authority and criminal justice reform, specifically making it easier for adults in custody to correspond with family and friends. She was among the six candidates last fall who sought the Ward 1 seat vacated with the resignation of Councilmember Indira Shoemaker. Chris Coleman won that race.
Blood bill pulled amid Red Cross objections. Would have permitted directed donations. Iowa House lawmakers on Tuesday killed a bill that would have allowed patients to broadly request blood donations from themselves or specific individuals after the American Red Cross and medical experts called the proposal potentially harmful for patients and disruptive to blood banks. Senate File 2369, which passed the upper chamber earlier this month on a 30-16 party line vote, would have required blood banks to comply with an individual's request for an autologous blood donation or a donation from a specific individual. Autologous donations are those made by a person for their own use during or after a planned medical procedure. Blood banks could refuse a patient's request only if they believed the requested donation would result in an imminent risk to the individual's life. Senator Jeff Edler, Republican of State Center, who said the bill was prompted by a constituent's concern, pointed to FDA guidance issued last year about autologous and directed blood donations. The agency has said that requests for donations with specific characteristics such as vaccination status, gender or sexual orientation, lack scientific support, and urged caution about websites or providers that advertise blood with specific characteristics. Edler's bill was shot down unanimously by a three-person House panel Tuesday as two Republicans and one Democrat opted to postpone the legislation indefinitely. Just because I've listened here, it's obvious to me that this is a problematic bill at this point, and I will be opposing, said Representative Thomas J. Moore, Republican of Griswold. Officials with the American Red Cross told lawmakers Tuesday that the bill, if passed, would put blood banks on shaky ground with federal regulations, as well as raise safety risks among a wide swath of patients. Blood is a drug. It's highly regulated by the FDA, said Emily Coberly, a divisional chief medical officer for the Red Cross. Just like a patient cannot order their own prescription medication, they cannot order their own blood transfusions. Coberly said she believed the bill posed risk to essentially everyone, all patients involved in this entire process who may need blood. Dr. Robert Schreck, an oncologist based in Des Moines, told Edler that although specific guidelines around donations have changed, the situation has not changed. We have always vehemently opposed directed transfusion, autologous transfusions, said Schreck, who founded Mission Cancer and Blood. Certain circumstances are certainly justified, but directed donations are rarely, rarely justified. Schreck said often ethical and safety concerns arose when specific individuals, like children, were asked by family members to be a donor. The would-be donor would be screened for lifestyle, health issues, and potentially sex life, and could be pressured to lie. He said he expected the bill would increase costs for blood banks and be extremely disruptive to their systems. And Samuel Choice, a fourth-year medical student at the University of Iowa, said that while autonomy for patients was important in medicine, the bill was not doing right by them. You're asking doctors to be impelled by the government to give care that they know is demonstrably worse, Choice said. It's as if you were going in for a surgery and your patient said, "Hi, I really don't want you to wash your hands before you do the surgery." Nobody other than Edler, the sponsor, spoke in favor of the bill Tuesday.
In a bill to seek to add more medical marijuana dispensaries in Iowa. A bill advancing through the Iowa legislature would allow for more dispensaries to sell medical marijuana in Iowa. House Study Bill 684 would increase the maximum number of dispensaries in the Iowa Medical Cannabidiol Program to 10, changing the portion of Iowa code that currently caps that total number at 5. License holders would only be able to hold 3 medical cannabidiol dispensary licenses under this legislation, a move advocates call an arbitrary condition that could limit businesses from expanding in the state's marketplace. A House subcommittee advanced the bill by unanimous vote, 3-0, for consideration by a full committee on Tuesday. I plan to sign off on the bill for the valid concern of consumer access, and I also think there's valid concern on the number of licenses someone can hold, said Representative Brent Sechrist, a Republican of Council Bluffs and chairperson of the House Ways and Means subcommittee that advanced the bill. The move to more dispensaries in Iowa has long been on the wish list of the Iowa Medical Cannabidiol Board, the state board that oversees the program. However, legislation over the years of this has repeatedly failed to pass out of the state capitol. Currently, Iowa's 5 medical marijuana dispensaries are located in Windsor Heights, Council Bluffs, Sioux City, Waterloo, and Iowa City. These facilities serve as the sole locations for Iowans to purchase medical cannabidiol products allowed under the state program, such as tinctures, topical lotions, and vaporizers. These facilities are owned and operated by the 2 companies that are also certified to grow and produce cannabidiol products in Iowa. These are Iowa Cannabis Company and Bud & Mary's. With only 5 dispensaries in the state, advocates have said many Iowans who live outside of those cities are unable to regularly access these products. I agree that patient access to medical cannabis here in the state of Iowa is a concern, said Representative John Forbes, a Democrat of Urbandale, during Tuesday's subcommittee. You get to certain areas of the state, people have to drive 2 hours plus. Most people can't do that, he said. In its recent policy recommendations to the Iowa legislature, the Iowa Medical Cannabidiol Board said lawmakers should give the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services the authority to issue licenses, quote, based on evidence-based demand analysis, end quote. Others who spoke at Tuesday's subcommittee hearing agreed with that recommendation. Jeff Bayank, a lobbyist for the Iowa Cannabis Company, opposed the provision of the bill that would limit the number of dispensary licenses a single entity could hold in the state. He said businesses should have the opportunity to compete for as many licenses as they want, noting that other entities like Come and Go are not told how many stores they can open in the state. If we make a business decision, we should be able to compete for any licenses if we want to, Beneke said. told lawmakers. If this bill does go forward for competitive reasons, because we're already in the marketplace, we already have a grow operation, we should have the opportunity to compete for any new licenses that come forward so that Iowans get the best possible company in those marketplaces. Forbes agreed the law should not limit how many licenses a specific business can hold, stating he believes it should be a free market. Forbes also called for expanding the medical cannabidiol program in other ways, such as allowing for more medical conditions to qualify to participate in the program and for flower to be added to the list of products. And that concludes our shift here for the last 90 minutes. Your readers have been Linda Lundgren and me, Twyla Glenn. It has been our pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Your new readers are Dorothy Hockenberg and Teresa Whitaker. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Here's Dorothy with our next article.
Good morning. We have the opinion from the Des Moines Register. This first one is a Your Turn, and its title is A Labor Movement Builds, Reject GOP Bill. And it is by Sammy Sheets. And Sammy represents portions of the Cedar Rapids in the Iowa House. The last decade has been devastating for worker protections in our state. In 2017, the legislature passed a law stripping Chapter 20 bargaining protections for state employees. As a state legislator, union members, and staff representative for Teamsters Local 238 in Cedar Rapids, I am deeply troubled by Senate File Number 2374. Advanced by Republican Senators Adrian Dickey and Jackson Schultz. The bill is a direct attack on the collective bargaining process for public sector union members in Iowa. The bill requires employers to submit lists of eligible employees for union certification elections to our state government within extremely tight deadlines. An employer's failure to submit this list will result in the decertification of the union, effectively silencing public sector workers and depriving them of their ability to advocate for fair treatment in the workplace. Such measures not only erode the foundational principles of collective action, but also undermine the democratic tenets inherent in labor relations. This legislation not only poses a threat to workers' rights, but also arrives at a pivotal moment when labor consciousness is rapidly growing across our state. In recent years, we have witnessed a remarkable surge in labor activism, with workers from various sectors standing up for their rights and winning strikes. This newfound sense of solidarity and determination has empowered workers to demand fair treatment and better working conditions. Senate File 2374 threatens to undermine these hard-won victories by effectively dismantling public sector unions. This bill is not merely about procedural issues, it strikes at the heart of fundamental rights. By undermining workers' ability to organize and advocate for themselves, it sets a dangerous precedent that jeopardizes the progress made in workers' rights. This legislation effectively grants employers unchecked authority while marginalizing workers' voices. Senate File 2374 represents a direct attack on the labor movement. It threatens the core principles of workers' rights and democratic governance. Lawmakers must heed the concern of workers and reject this misguided legislation. Instead, they should focus on policies that empower workers and uphold their rights. We should not allow this bill to diminish the growing labor consciousness and solidarity that we have witnessed across our state. It is crucial to stand together and ensure that workers in Iowa are treated with the dignity and respect they deserve. Again, that was by Sammy Sheets, who represents a portion of Cedar Rapids in the Iowa House.
Okay, and I'm going to read the other guest columnist column here from David Skidmore. Will Johnson repeat the pre-World War II isolationist error? House Speaker Mike Johnson faces a critical decision that could align his legacy with that of Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, who, in 1920, spearheaded the Senate Republicans' rejection of the Treaty of Versailles, thus declining United States membership in the new League of Nations. This was a stunning defeat for President Woodrow Wilson, who had championed the League as an alternative to the imperialism and power politics he considered responsible for World War I. The League sought to ensure peace by committing members to come to the defense of any other members who faced aggression. The prospect of a collective response would give pause to any aggressor otherwise tempted to attack a weaker neighbor. But without the leadership of the United States, already the greatest power of the era, the League's collective security mechanism lost all credibility. When Japan invaded China in 1931, the League sent a fact-finding team, but otherwise failed to act. Following Italy's invasion of Ethiopia in 1935, the League imposed some ineffective sanctions, but was otherwise helpless to reverse Italy's aggression. The League likewise stood by while Nazi Germany took the Sudetenland in 1938. Through all these events, as the world stumbled toward a Second World War, within a generation, the United States sought safety in isolation. A meek giant lulled into complacency by its geographic remoteness. The United States sat on the sidelines as aggressors threatened the peace in both Europe and Asia. Massive rallies organized under the slogan America First sought to avoid the kinds of sacrifices that had been made along the trench lines in Europe. Alas, peace and security could not be bought so cheaply. American security was bound up with the security of others. The American economy could not thrive if hostile rivals used violence to gain exclusive control over vast concentrations of industrial power and raw materials. Our democracy would be imperiled in a world dominated by autocracies. The isolationist illusion was finally punctured by the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Following World War II, a new generation of leaders accepted the responsibilities of global leadership and built a set of American-centered alliances to keep the peace in Europe and East Asia. These alliances have secured the basis for spheres of remarkable peace, prosperity, and democracy in both regions, even in the face of great power threats, both past and present. The continued stability and peace in Europe and Asia depend upon the strength and credibility of the American commitments to the security of our partners. And this is where Mike Johnson, the Republican Speaker, faces a choice potentially as momentous as that of Senator Lodge. Johnson holds the fate of Ukraine in his hands, and so too the standing of America's international leadership. Although Ukraine is not a treaty ally, the United States, both individually and through NATO, has made public commitments to assist Ukraine in defending itself from Russian aggression. The very fact that the current arms aid package for Ukraine has been held up in Congress for months has already harmed the credibility of America's word. Should the standoff result in a failure to resume arms shipments, especially if followed by major Russian battlefield advances, America's friends and rivals alike will be forced to reconsider their strategic position in a world of renewed American isolationism. Already, Donald Trump's reckless threats to pull out of NATO have damaged the alliance, regardless of whether he wins the presidency or carries through on the threat. Our allies now understand that America's commitment to their security is in question, and so do our rivals. Johnson should calm such fears by bringing an aid package for Ukraine to a vote in the House, where it would likely pass. If he fails to do so, then this moment will well be remembered as a turning point akin to the failure of the League of Nations vote in the Senate, and the first step into a new era of isolationism and insecurity. And that article again was from David Skidmore, who is a professor of political science at Drake University.
Our letters to the editors today, the first one is from Roger Jacobson of West Des Moines. Of course, proposals to limit power of auditor are political. I would take issue with State Senator Michael Bousselot's statement that only in politics can hiring an independent accountant be political. The context is reducing the authority of the state auditor. You don't have to be a CPA, which I am, to know that last year allowing the audited departments to withhold documents would make it impossible to have a complete audit. This year, Bousselot wants the departments to hire their own auditors rather than use the state auditor, though that office would be allowed to review the work. Not very economically beneficial. These two attempts to reduce the authority of the auditor are political, as the auditor is the only state office not held by the party in power. These provisions are insulting to our intelligence and insulting to the voters who elected the state auditor. And now these limitations are an attempt to overturn that election. These same attempts were used to try and limit the authority of Tom Miller, the previous Attorney General. No limitations are proposed for the new Attorney General. This would seem to support the old saying, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. With these provisions in place, corruption is soon to follow. That by Roger Jacobson of West Des Moines. Our next one is from Jeff Klingon of Van Meter. Public transit projects deserve more investment. I'm amazed that the Des Moines City Council is considering cutting back an already inadequate public transit system. I learned the importance of public transportation during my final 10 years of my working career, moving homeless people into productive society. It can't be done without a good transit system. Most of today's jobs are located where the poor can't afford to live. Most poor folks live a good distance from a grocery store or doctor. This council likes to pass resolutions about the city becoming carbon neutral, but when it comes to funding public transit, it ain't worth a 2.5% franchise fee. All talk and no hat. That from Jeff Klingon of Van Meter. This next is from Mark Mahoney of Urbandale. Are all lives precious? So, in Alabama, frozen embryos are protected, but the death penalty is in full effect? I'm beyond confused. Again from Mark Mahoney of Urbandale. And our last one is from Jim Whalen of Des Moines. Iowa representatives should force a vote on Ukrainian aid. The United States is in danger of breaking a promise to provide military aid to help Ukraine fight Russian invaders, simply because House Speaker Mike Johnson won't allow the House to vote on a Senate bill that allocated $61 billion in military aid for Ukraine. While Donald Trump and his devotees play political games, Ukrainian troops are forced to ration ammunition, which puts them at a considerable disadvantage when fighting the Russians. The Ukrainian people are dying every day from Russian bombing and rocket attacks because Ukraine no longer has the necessary ammunition and equipment to defend its people. The only way to bring the Senate bill to a vote without Johnson's consent is to use one of several arcane parliamentary rules, all of which would require at least four Republicans to vote with Democrats. All four of Iowa's representatives should take a cue from our senators and put the need to support a Democratic ally above the political whims of one man. If we abandon Ukraine now, we will be responsible for hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian deaths, not to mention the other depredations inflicted upon them by vengeful Russian conquerors. Again, that from Jim Whalen of Des Moines.
Okay, we're going to turn to the sports section, and we're going to start with what you can catch on TV today. In college basketball, men's college basketball, at 5:30 this evening on FS1, Nebraska is at Ohio State. At 6 p.m. on CBS SN, William & Mary is at Elon. On ESPN2, Memphis is at East Carolina. ESPNU, Longwood at Gardner-Webb. At 7:30 p.m. on FS1, Michigan at Rutgers, but maybe it's Rutgers. Pac-12 Network is showing Stanford at Utah. At 8 p.m. on CBS SN, New Mexico State at Liberty. ESPNU, Tennessee State at Little Rock. On WCCN, Santa Clara at Portland. And at 9:30 p.m. on FS1, UCLA is at Washington. On Pac-12 Network, Southern Cal is at Washington State. At 10 p.m. on CBS SN, St. Mary's, California is at Pepperdine. And on ESPN2, Gonzaga at San Francisco. In women's college basketball, at 5 p.m. this evening on ACCN, Clemson at Wake Forest. On BTN, Wisconsin at Maryland. At 6 p.m. on ESPN, Virginia Tech at Notre Dame. On SECN, Texas A&M at Tennessee. At 7 p.m. on ACCN, Florida State at Louisville. On BTN, Illinois at Michigan State. At 8 p.m. on ESPN2, LSU at Georgia. On SECN, South Carolina at Arkansas. And in Major League Baseball, you can catch some spring training today. At noon on MLBN, Philadelphia versus Toronto in Dunedin, Florida. At 7 p.m., also on MLBN, we have the L.A. Dodgers versus Cincinnati at Goodyear, Arizona. In NBA basketball, at 6:30 p.m. this evening on TNT, Golden State is at New York. At 9 p.m. on TNT, Miami at Denver. And if you're missing NFL football, at 2 p.m. today on NFLN, there is an NFL scouting combine with defensive linemen and linebackers in Indianapolis. And NHL hockey at 6 p.m. on ESPN and Hulu, Carolina at Columbus. At 8 p.m. on ESPN, Colorado at Chicago. And in men's soccer, at 1:35 p.m. today on FS2, the French Cup has Le Puy Foot versus Rennes in the quarterfinal at Saint-Étienne, France. At 7:05 p.m. on FS2, the CONCACAF Champions Cup. Independiente at New England Revolution, the first round, leg two. And finally, in tennis this evening at 5 p.m., you can, in San Diego at the WTA, you've got, the early rounds and the ATP quarterfinals. And just for a short recap here, we've got Class 5A girls hoops semifinals today. Dowling Catholic is going to play Cedar Falls in the semifinals Thursday at 11:45 a.m. today. Well, that's already started at Wells Fargo Arena, or it will be starting soon. And you've got the Johnston Dragons is going to play Waukee in the semifinals. They were playing this morning at 10 a.m. That's going on. And also, you've got Waukee plays Johnston in the state semifinal at 10 a.m. Well, that's the same game. Sorry about that. They've got two different pictures there. And then you've got the Dallas Center Grimes. This is in boys now. Dallas Center Grimes knocks off Waukee to secure trip to state. The second-seeded Dallas Center Grimes avenged a loss in last year's sub-state final as the Mustangs took down number one Waukee 66-59 on Tuesday in Indianola. The victory secured a trip to next week's Class 4A state tournament. Other Des Moines area schools to earn Class 4A state tournament berths on Tuesday included Ankeny, Johnston, and Valley. The Mustang center, Calix Cahill, took control in the second half, helping DCG pull away from a 29-all halftime tie by scoring 17 points in the final 16 minutes. Cahill finished the night with 29 points, well above his season average of 15.6 points per game. All of his points Tuesday came from the paint or free throws. Dallas Center Grimes' Jackson Green chipped 12 points, leading the team with 2 3-pointers. Tate Perrin held his own with 8 points. Waukee tried to keep pace with the Mustangs in the second half, drilling 5 3-pointers. Mason Costello led the Warriors with 15 points. Jai White and Owen Skipper each tallied 11 points. Dallas Center Grimes, whose record is 20-3, is the 8th seed in next week's Class 4A state tournament in Des Moines. The Mustangs will take on top-seeded Cedar Rapids, whose record is 23-0, at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, March 6th at Wells Fargo Arena. Kennedy is the only undefeated team in 4A following a 57-55 win Tuesday night over North Scott. And they've got some other captions here on the boys basketball Class 4A that qualify for state. We have shows a picture of Valley's Kiki Deng, who takes a shot over Norwalk's Aiden Harder during Tuesday's Class 4A sub-state final at Des Moines Lincoln. Valley won 75-64 to advance to next week's state tournament. And other Des Moines area teams that qualified on Tuesday included Ankeny, Dallas Center Grimes, and Johnston. And it also shows a picture of the Valley fans getting fired up for the Tigers during Tuesday's sub-state final against Norwalk at Des Moines Lincoln. Let's see if we've got some other short articles here we can talk about. Iowa guard Bowen likely done for season with knee injury. So now we're talking about college basketball out of Iowa City. Sophomore guard DeSante Bowen is likely done for the season, Iowa men's basketball coach Fran McCaffrey said Tuesday. Bowen, who has been dealing with a lingering knee injury, has not played since Iowa's loss at Maryland on February 14th. McCaffrey said Bowen is likely to undergo surgery in less than 2 weeks. He's a tough kid, McCaffrey said of Bowen following Iowa's win over Penn State on Tuesday. He's been trying to play through it, and it just got to the point where it was time. Bowen began the season as a key part of Iowa's rotation, starting the first 8 games of the season, but his minutes began to dwindle with the emergence of Josh Dix and solid play off the bench from Brock Harding. Bowen has scored just 17 points since the calendar flipped to 2024. If Bowen does not play the rest of If Bowen does not play the rest of the 23-24 campaign, he will finish averaging 4.4 points, 1.3 rebounds, and 2 assists per game in 25 appearances. We're all pulling for him as he goes through that difficulty, McCaffrey said, but he's a terrific young man.
Well, listeners, today we have a new guest reader, and she's Judy Blank, and she's going to do the Dear Abby. Judy?
Thank you. Hi, this is Dear Abby by Abigail Van Buren. Niece's wedding planning charts disturbing course. Dear Abby, my niece, who is engaged, is blossoming into a full-fledged bridezilla. She has upset her mother so deeply that she may not attend the wedding. The bride is dictating what her guests are to wear in addition to telling her mother what she is to wear that day. She has also ordered my sister to get hair extensions and have her makeup professionally done. The list goes on and on. She brought her girlfriends to the bridal shop and, without asking about a budget, tried on gown after gown with no regard to cost. She fell in love with one that is beyond her mother's budget and demanded, "This is my dress." My sister, wanting to avoid a scene, paid for it. My sister has been excluded from all the wedding planning. The bride is deferring to her father and stepmother, who are paying for most of the wedding. If anyone offers a suggestion or asks a question, it is met with hostility. How do we handle this? My sister feels defeated and is deeply hurt by her daughter's actions. And that's Aunt of a Monster. And Abby says, "Dear Aunt, this production, I hesitate to call it a wedding, has gone so far out of control that there is nothing you or your sister can do about it. Her chance to intervene and inject some sobriety vanished the moment she paid for the bridal gown she couldn't afford. If your sister can't afford hair extensions and a professional makeup job for her daughter's special day, she should consider coming just as she is and forgo being part of the wedding. She should also thank her higher power that she isn't ordered to fly to Bermuda or Bali in order to participate." The next one is, "Dear Abby, my wife has been neglectful and hateful towards me ever since I was verbally abusive more than 4 years ago. I had fallen into a serious substance addiction around the same time, but I've been clean for more than a year. The addiction was another reason she is hateful toward me and holds a grudge. I understand how addiction affects loved ones and that our relationship is probably over. My problem is we have two very young children and split the mortgage and all the other bills 50-50. I cannot afford to live on my own. She can't afford to live alone either. I can't imagine trying to pay child support as well as rent somewhere else, even if I got another full-time job. I have done everything I can to make amends, but there is no hope. We tried counseling. It didn't work. I don't want to abandon the kids, but I don't know what to do. Is there any hope at all? Low in Ohio. Dear Low, so the abused has become the abuser. Unless your wife is willing to bury the hatchet somewhere other than in you and agree to marriage counseling with a different therapist, I don't think there is hope for the two of you. Ask her if, for the sake of the kids, she is willing to try. But if she refuses, consult an attorney about separating as amicably as possible."
Thank you. That was great. Okay, we're going to do a couple quick little blurbs from our different states. Out of Iowa, in Des Moines, with more than 100 people in attendance and carrying signs with slogans such as "Stop the War on Workers" and "Unions Built the Middle Class," a gathering of union members took their message to the Iowa Capitol on Monday afternoon. And in Nebraska, out of Omaha, Nebraska prosecutors have decided not to seek the death penalty in the December killing of a Catholic priest inside his home, but will pursue execution in the brutal killing of a retiree during a break-in that happened in the same tiny town 4 months earlier. And finally, out of South Dakota, Pierre, the House Judiciary Committee passed a bill to let school principals give written permission to individuals 21 or older with an enhanced permit to carry a concealed pistol at public elementary or secondary schools. And that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Teresa Whitaker, and my partner at the microphone has been Dorothy Hockenberg. Earlier, you heard from Linda Lundgren and Twyla Glenn. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.